is VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
By 2050, one in four people on our planet will be African. So this is the future. There's not a single challenge in the United States or anywhere around the world, like COVID, like climate, that can be addressed by any one country acting alone.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken explaining why he is in Africa. Details coming up. Also, Chad's military government and rebels have signed a pledge to facilitate national reconciliation. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Our top story. One day before the Kenyan elections, final preparations are going full steam ahead. I spoke with VOA's Africa 54 TV managing editor, Vincent McCorry, on the goings-on today in Nairobi, as well as the rest of the country.
Today the biggest activity has been delivering the ballot boxes and the ballot papers to the different polling stations across the country, the hundreds and thousands of them. And, they're supposed to be in place by the end of today. Now, from the reports I was looking at, most have arrived. They're in the polling stations where they're supposed to be. Polling agents are there. Representatives of the various candidates were there to witness the ballot boxes arrive. The officials are saying they're planning, or rather they are determined to make sure all polling material will be present before the end of today in all polling centers across the country. Now, there are other places where the ballot boxes hadn't arrived midday today, but they said it was just a matter of hours. They're on the way. And of course, the government has different ways of transporting this material by road, by air, by helicopter. But they say everything will be in position by the end of this day.
And talking to you, Vincent, you also mentioned that people who reside in the capital are now traveling to various parts of the country to cast their ballots. Could you expound on that? Talk to us briefly about what that is all about.
Yes. Over the weekend up to today, Monday, most people or a great number of people have been traveling to their hometowns. This is because, according to the law, you're supposed to vote where you chose to be registered. And a great number of people have registered to vote in their hometowns where they go to elect their local representatives, members of parliament, senators, as well as members of the county assemblies. So they attach a lot of importance to voting in their hometowns. I went around and spoke to a few people at the bus stations who were on the way home, and they said it is so important for them to participate in the electing people in their hometowns, because while they live in Nairobi and work here, that's where to them home is. And so they want to determine who will be their leader, because whatever happens in their hometown is really what is important to them than what happens perhaps here in Nairobi.
And finally, Vincent, Kenya, you know, has a history of violence regarding elections, but so far things are very positive. Things are calm and quiet. You are there. From your vantage point, how does the security situation look like?
I always remind people that Kenya operates and functions perfectly normal up until the day after the election. So when you look around, of course, you don't see any evidence of potential danger or sign of violence. Of course, there's no protest going on. People just have been participating in campaign discussions. They've been all over talking about their favorite candidates and then going about their businesses as usual. So what happens is that problems start showing up the day after the election or the evening of the election day when the numbers start coming in. Now, if there are issues with those numbers or if there are issues early in the day, which seem to have, to some degree, impacted the smooth operation, the smooth running of the process, you start hearing voices, you start hearing sounds here and there from candidates, from citizens. And usually there can be an eruption of violence, as we've seen at some level, not to say everything is going to be at the scale of 2007. Meanwhile, though, the government has said it's making sure it's putting everything in place in case of a situation of violence or demonstration. So they have deployed law enforcement and enforcement officers to all corners of the country. I personally witnessed the anti-riot trucks being ferried, I suppose, to different towns, just in anticipation of any form of violence or demonstrations. The president of the nation says they will deal accordingly with anybody who tries to foment chaos or who tries to cause any kind of risk to the process itself. So the government says it's ready. Citizens say they are not willing to participate in violence. And now we'll just wait and see how things look like.
That was VOA's Africa 54 TV managing editor Vincent Mokori speaking with me from Nairobi. Candidates in presidential election are wrapping up their campaigns for tomorrow's vote after parties spent heavily, often lavish displays of wealth. Despite economic woes and a massive rich-poor gap, spending in Kenya's election was among the highest in the world, raising concerns about its impact on the nation's democratic development. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
In the air, on the ground, the lavish display of wealth in Kenya's August 9 elections is almost unmatched, say experts. Tom Wolf is an American pollster and political researcher in Nairobi.
Kenyan elections are among the most expensive in the world in terms of the cost per vote by the electoral management body, our IEBC, but also in terms of on-the-ground financing.
Derek Mahandia, a program officer at Transparency International Kenya, agrees.
It will cost you a bit more than 4 billion Kenyan shillings just to become a president.
4 billion shillings is about $33.5 million. A race for governor runs about $336,000 and a bid for parliament, roughly $168,000, according to Transparency International Kenya. Critics say the high cost of running for political office in Kenya has been a barrier for many women, the young, and persons living with disabilities. Beth Ngunyi is running for parliament in Kirinyaga County, her fourth attempt as an independent. She says it is too costly to run as a candidate for a political party because of the high nomination fee required.
The higher the seat, the higher the money they demand. And you've got to give them, because if you don't give them, they won't even allow you to address the gatherings.
Political campaigns around the world are inherently expensive. But observers say in Kenya, campaigns are largely unchecked and unregulated. Because many people live below the poverty line, observers say voters are more susceptible to bribery by wealthy politicians, fueling a cycle of government corruption. Here again is Derek Mahandia.
Because of this unregulated spending, those in power always look towards corruption as a reliable source of money for their campaigns, because they cannot afford to use their money. That would be too risky. What if they failed?
Kenya's 2010 constitution requires the country's electoral body, the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, to develop campaign financing and spending regulations. All attempts by the commission have been rejected by Parliament. Unless checks and balances are put in place, observers say, politics in Kenya will largely remain a preserve of the rich. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
A military officer in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo says rebels killed 15 civilians and an army captain in Ituri province over the weekend. The French press agency AFP quotes military governor Colonel Siro Simba as saying rebels from the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF, are suspected of killing 10 people in the village of Kandoi on Friday night. On Saturday, the ADF killed 5 in a neighboring village, Bandiboli. Simba said one army captain and an ADF fighter were also killed. AFP says the deaths bring the total number of killings to 37 since Friday. The Allied Democratic Forces are among 120 rebel groups fighting in the mineral-rich eastern part of the Congo. The ADF, an Islamic State group said to originate in Uganda, regularly stages attacks in both countries. Last November, they were blamed for bomb attacks in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Chad's military government and 42 of 47 rebel groups have signed a pledge to facilitate national reconciliation talks on August 20th. The talks will focus on setting the date and rules for elections leading to a civilian administration, which were set for October. The Associated Press says all parties to the deal, which was signed in Qatar, agreed to a ceasefire, with the government promising not to take police or military action against any of the signatories. Chad's foreign minister said the talks were difficult, but called the pledge a chance for a sustainable peace. Among the groups that did not sign today is the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, known by its French acronym FACT. The AP says it sought the release of more than 300 of its fighters and had, like other groups, called for the head of state, Mahamat Idriss Deby, to promise not to run in the elections. The military government said that decision could only be made in a national dialogue. Chad's foreign minister said he was surprised that FACT had not signed, but said all armed groups could take part in the talks. FACT says it remains prepared for future dialogue. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in South Africa today, part of a visit to three African countries in what some analysts say is an attempt by Washington to counter Russian and Chinese influence on the continent. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov toured Africa last month, and several high-ranking U.S. diplomats have been visiting recently. African political analysts say the visits by both the American and Russian delegations, plus China's continued influence, shows the great world powers are recognizing the continent's growing importance. Darren Taylor reports.
On South Africa's ENCA news channel, Blinken was pragmatic in explaining why he's in Africa.
By 2050, one in four people on our planet will be African. So this is the future. There's not a single challenge in the United States or anywhere around the world, like COVID, like climate, that can be addressed by any one country acting alone. And the idea that we would try to meet these challenges without Africa makes absolutely no sense.
South Africa, the continent's second largest and most industrialized economy, is a leader in the developing world. Together with Brazil, Russia, India, and China, it's part of a group of emerging economies called BRICS. Africa has strong historical ties with both China and Russia. Moscow and Beijing supported the continent's struggles against colonialism. They gave weapons, military training, and money to South Africa's ruling African National Congress to fight apartheid. Many in Africa regard the US as having supported colonialism and white minority rule. Russian President Vladimir Putin has encouraged BRICS countries to work together to fight what he called selfish actions of the West. Blinken said his visit to Africa is about providing a choice and to show that Washington's serious about partnering with Africa.
So a lot of what we'll be talking about is how together we're actually working on strengthening healthcare systems, how we're creating capacity here in Africa, for example, not just in producing vaccines for the future, but food security. We've seen a dramatic rise in food insecurity. And what I'm hearing from so many partners around the continent is not only are people looking for assistance in the immediate, but even more important, looking to build self-sustaining indigenous capacity for food production.
International relations expert at the University of Johannesburg, Professor David Monya, says the U.S., currently Africa's third largest trade partner, is critical to growth on the continent. But he's convinced Blinken's visit is at least partly about trying to drive a wedge between Africa and China and Russia.
I think the perception in Washington is that whoever Washington chooses to be an enemy for any given moment is automatically everyone else's enemy. That's where the problem is. I think the position is quite clear. South Africa and Africa do not take sides. It's not on the side of China, nor is it on the side of the United States.
Monya says a statement last week by the U.S. ambassador to the UN is clear evidence of Washington pressuring Africa to take sides. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who just finished her own diplomatic trip to Africa, said countries, including in Africa, that buy U.S. sanctioned products such as oil could have actions taken against them. Monya says it's up to Africans themselves to find ways to counter pressure, whatever its source.
I think the day the continent speak with one voice, unite and integrate, develop and ensure that it protects its own interests and concentrating on the interests of its people instead of others from outside the continent, whether the West or East, I think that's the day when the whole international community will start respecting the continent. And we need assistance from strategic partners such as the United States, but that has to be done with respect as equal partners.
After talking today with South African counterpart Naledi Pandor, Blinken will visit Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies. I am Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. CNN has uncovered an elaborate Russian scheme to plunder Sudan's gold as a way to bolster Russia against strong Western sanctions and to help finance Moscow's war effort in Ukraine. Documents and interviews in the CNN report also suggest Russia has colluded with Sudan's military leaders, allowing billions of dollars in gold to bypass Sudanese authorities and be flown out of the country. Heather Ashby, a senior program officer and Russian analyst with the United States Institute of Peace, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the report on Russia's plundering of Sudan's gold appears to be true.
Russia has a long history of engaging in these type of smuggling operations that go back to the early Soviet period after the Bolshevik Revolution from my own research. And so during that time period, because of the difficulty of a collapse in state, they were taking the Tsar's jewels and selling them around the world. And so this has been an aspect of the way the Russian system has operated for 100 years of engaging in different types of illegal smuggling practices to get around sanctions, to get around other rules of the international system. So I'm definitely not surprised to hear this. The second aspect of the article and your question that I want to highlight is that Russia was also helping Venezuela get around the sanctions that were imposed on their government, and they were helping to transport that gold to Venezuelan gold to different parts of the world, particularly in East Africa. So this is just building up on that long history of Russia smuggling, as well as their support and help of the Venezuelan regime to get around sanctions.
How come we don't hear more about this? How come this isn't really talked about in public?
I think there's so much going on with Russia's war against Ukraine, that unjustified war, that it's difficult to pull the thread on so many other issues that are connected to that, as well as the sanctions, that it may not receive enough attention. The other aspect is, given the countries where Russia is active in Africa, it's difficult to have journalists go to those countries and dig deeper. There is a situation that happened in the Central African Republic a few years ago. Investigative journalists go into the Central African Republic to understand what Russia was doing in partnership with the Carr government, and those journalists were murdered. And so that's part of the reasons why you don't hear these stories, because of the difficulty in tracking that information and making sure journalists are safe when they're conducting that research.
What do Sudan's military rulers get out of the deal?
I think right now, since they staged that coup that happened late last year, they may be looking for a country to help endorse their system, because the U.S., the Europeans, and the international system condemned that coup and the attacks against pro-democracy protesters, that Russia becomes this other option of helping to endorse the government and their practices.
Where are these smuggling operations occurring inside Sudan?
They are in different parts of Sudan. One is that you can see it where Sudan's border meets the Central African Republic, where Russia is active through the Wagner Group, a private mercenary company. And then you can see it move in then north out of the country.
Do you know anything about this Russian in particular? He's a convicted kidnapper. I think you pronounce his name Alexander Sergeyevich Kuznetsov.
I haven't heard much about him, but that's not too surprising, because it's so difficult to receive information about the individuals who are connected with Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's heavily sanctioned and has been reported to be the funder for the Wagner Group that's spread across different parts of Africa. And so it's challenging for researchers, analysts like myself, as well as journalists, to know exactly what is the composition of the Wagner Group, Prigozhin's network, and the individuals involved. Every now and then, such as this situation, you'll find the name of an individual that will shed some light on it and enable journalists, analysts, and governments to dig deeper to understand what this network looks like.
That was Heather Ashby, a senior program officer for the Center on Russia and Europe with the U.S. Institute of Peace. She was speaking with my colleague, Kyle Van Dam, from Washington.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
The French news agency AFP says several police officers were killed yesterday by unidentified assailants in southern Mali. The Directorate General of the National Police says the incident took place in the town of Sona, near the country's border with Burkina Faso, as a team from the Sona Frontier Police Station struck an explosive device followed by heavy fire. The attack left five officers dead, with one wounded and three missing. The wire service says some local officials describe the attackers as terrorists. AFP says in another incident, the army is repelling an attack by jihadists in Mali's northeast Gao region. It says the army claims it is fighting off an assault by the Islamic State and the Greater Sahara. Mali has been struggling for years to end an Islamist insurgency, which led to a military government taking power 2 years ago. London's Horniman Museum says it will return dozens of artifacts looted by British soldiers in Nigeria, including 12 of the famed Benin bronzes. The French news agency AFP says ownership of 72 objects, which were forcibly removed from Benin City during the British military incursion in February 1897, will be transferred to the Nigerian government. Thousands of Nigeria's so-called Benin bronzes, 16th to the 18th century metal plaques and sculptures, were looted from the palace of the ancient Benin Kingdom and ended up in museums across the U.S. and Europe. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.